Welcome to the Laverne Cox Show, a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio.
Music kind of comes and goes.
Mm-hmm. Particularly pop music.
Yeah. And so she's turned everything on its head as a creator. I don't even know what the right word for it. Artist, creator. I don't know what to call her anymore because she's just beyond the labels.
She's beyond.
She's beyond.
Beyond Beyonce.
Yeah.
Hi, welcome to the Laverne Cox Show. I'm Laverne Cox. When I think about why Beyoncé Giselle Knowles Carter means so much to me, I think about the year Destiny's Child's first album came out. It was a self-titled album. It came out in 1998. That was the year that I started my medical transition. And so as long as I have publicly identified as a woman, Destiny's Child and Beyoncé have kind of been in my life, and I feel like I've sort of grown up with Beyoncé in a way. I just saw so much of myself, and she's obviously influenced a lot of my aesthetic choices. She's just given me a lot of permission over the years to explore different parts of myself through her music and through her performances. So I am insanely excited about today's conversation. When I knew I was going to be doing a podcast and knew I wanted to have an episode about Beyoncé, I just don't want to have an episode where I'm just like fanning out over Beyoncé, although that would be perfectly legitimate. I wanted to sort of, you know, honor the depth of her work. And I was like, who can we bring on to have a conversation about Beyoncé? And I thought about Kevin Allred. So a little bit about Kevin. Kevin Allred is an award-winning author, speaker, educator, and musician who says he loves Beyoncé above all else. In 2010, he created a college curriculum, Politicizing Beyoncé, which paired Beyoncé music with Black feminist literature to interrogate American race, gender, and sexual politics. He is the author of Ain't I a Diva, Beyoncé and the Power of Pop Culture Pedagogy. We go there, and it's so fun. It's so awesome. I can't wait for you to hear this. Please enjoy my conversation with Kevin Allred. Hello, Kevin.
Hi.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm good as anyone can be during these times, but you know.
I do know. So I am really nervous and excited about having this conversation with you. And what was interesting preparing for this was reading your book and realizing that it's not just an homage to Beyoncé, that it's also a celebration of Black feminist writers and thinkers. And then I would put on music and then I would start dancing and have all of my feelings. And so I have such a complicated relationship to Beyoncé. And it sounds like you do as well. In your book, you say that B-Day was sort of your indoctrination into the Beehive.
Yeah.
Why was B-Day the moment for you as opposed to, you know, Dangerously in Love or Destiny's Child?
I mean, it just was like a feeling for me. I don't know, like that album hit me different. Of course, I'd been a fan of hers. Like you can't not be. Some people try not to be, but you have to try hard not to be a fan of Beyoncé. Just the music
so
and the fun and, you know, everything. But I just distinctly remember like sitting at the desk I had at the time and like hearing Deja Vu start and like the bass rattle and this feeling of this whole new sound. It was, for me, I think a pivotal moment where she like started to claim an independence that we've now seen blossom. But it was that moment where she like went away from all the, you know, the record companies. She had played Dena Jones in Dreamgirls and she was like powerless and she wanted to like hit back really hard. And I don't know, that just like hit me in a way that some of her other music hadn't. And I became like a fan times a million at that moment. I was just a fan before, and then that just like pushed it into the stratosphere, I guess.
I think for me, I was a fan since Destiny's Child, since No, No, No. I remember seeing them on TRL. I think it was the first time I became aware of Destiny's Child. I remember they did an interview. They didn't perform and they talked and I was like, who are these cute girls, you know? And then I heard the song and I became obsessed. And then the writings on the wall like solidified it for me. When Bills, Bills, Bills came out, I was
I was all in.
Yeah.
And then say my name and then jump and jump. And anyway, you know the chronology. But I think it was B-Day, but it was also, it happened like with the Beyonce Experience concert, you know, it was her first visual album. When I saw the concert and understood that she was on a new level as a live performer, like I went to a new level. And I think she gave me permission to queen out in a way that I had not felt before because, and this is really interesting, I'm literally having this aha moment right now. I'm like, I started my medical transition in 1998, the year that Destiny's Child's first album came out. But I was very much like, at that time in New York and I was in the club scene, people wanted to sort of conflate my identity with being drag. Mm. And I needed to sort of divorce myself from like, you know, gay clubs and gay culture because I'm like, I'm a woman, I'm not a drag queen. And like, I saw this cis black woman who was beautiful and amazing, who was embracing all this sort of over the top drag queen-esque, obviously inspired movement. And it just gave me permission to own that part of myself.
Channeling Josephine Baker too, let's not forget.
I will never forget.
Yeah, the Deja Vu video and those performances, like that's how she kind of unveiled that era. And it was like, oh damn, this is something that we haven't seen from her before. Yeah.
You referenced the Fashion Rocks live performance, which was dedicated to Josephine Baker, and she actually wore the banana skirt. And the movement is very much influenced by Josephine Baker, who's been a huge influence for me. But that Fashion Rocks performance for me is still one of my favorites. The wind, she sounded so great. And I love the Deja Vu choreography so much. Like, I'm obsessed with that choreo that's very African dance influenced, very Josephine Baker influenced.
It seems like one of those first homage moments to Black women of the past, Black entertainers, Black feminist history even. And it's nothing to say that she does that now because she's, you know, homecoming. She's interspersed with quotes and all of this stuff. And she's kind of taken on the role of teacher herself. And she's like educating the masses about all this stuff. But I think that was another moment that was impactful because it was like, this isn't just a pop single. This isn't just a song. She's like teaching us something too with it.
Absolutely.
And that to me, obviously, because I was like going into being a teacher, I was like, oh, cool. So we can look to this as a teaching tool as well.
Yeah. You referenced in your book an article by Daphne Brooks from The Nation magazine.
Sugar Mama Politicized, yeah.
Sugar Mama Politicized. You write that Brooks imagines that Beyonce was reclaiming a meticulously nuanced political image of Black women with her work, participating in larger Black feminist historical trajectory. Can you talk to us a little bit about Brooks's inspiring you to create the course curriculum, Politicizing Beyonce, that you did over 11 years ago?
Yeah, that article, again, just like the B-Day album, was kind of like a bombshell to me. That article was too, because I'd been listening to Beyonce now in this new way, and it was the first critical writing about Beyonce that I'd ever come across. I mean, it may be the first like critical analysis of Beyonce that exists. But it was really an album review, but it got into all of this stuff about the historical context of the release of B-Day, which is a year almost to the date after Hurricane Katrina has come through, that same geography, really, like she's, because she's also bringing forth this Gulf Coast, so much Gulf Coast imagery on that album.
Yes.
And it just got the wheels in my head thinking about how we could analyze other Beyonce stuff. So it like broke open these floodgates of inquiry and questions and listening to her in a different way that I didn't even know existed. You know, people will write 32 articles about analyzing a Shakespeare play or whatever. And I was like, this is the level Beyonce's on now. She's producing work that can be taken so many different ways and analyzed in so many directions. Once you dig into the evidence she puts into the videos, starting at B-Day, you see her grow in ways that have now borne fruit.
Oh, yeah.
And so that article by Daphne Brooks and a lot of her other writing about music just kind of was so inspirational to me that like you could look at something that people just take as pop and go so much deeper.
Yeah, I checked out Daphne Brooks's article, and it's really stunning and beautiful. And I'm obsessed with Beyonce, but I've always the sort of overt materialism that is in the music, right? Beyonce seemingly is very materialistic, but the way that Brooks puts it is that, you know, I guess in a capitalist society, money is sort of synonymous with power and sort of the role reversal. And the way she even talked about sugar mama, it's so interesting because I've been thinking about sugar mama in a very different way. I have no desire to be a sugar mama, right? We've seen like Black women who are the bread winners, Sherry Shepherd, Wendy Williams, Mel B, Mary J. Blige, are four Black women who I love, all of them I love dearly, who had very public divorces from men who are now getting crazy amounts of alimony from them or got crazy settlements. And it felt very, particularly the Sherry Shepherd moment, where it just felt very sort of exploitative and just felt very, as a Black woman in my 40s myself, I'm like, I never want that situation. But then, you know, I've recently started hanging out with a dude and I was just like, I literally had that. Then when she starts the song, damn, that was so good. I think I'm going to buy him a short set. Or I was like, I get it. I get like being so turned out that you just like want to just, you know, shake your purse and just like, come on, boy. You know, so, yeah. So it's really complicated. But I also think there's a piece of like, who has the power in relationships is what Brooks seems to be sort of asking us to interrogate and look at when we look at songs like Sugar Mama and Upgrade You. What are your thoughts on the materialism or the capitalism?
The capitalism in her music is like the toughest nut to crack, I guess, you know, like, and at one point I came to the conclusion that, you know, she may very well be material, like she may not mean it to be commentary on anything else, and she may be materialistic, that's fine, like whatever, but it does open up spaces for conversation about materialism and capitalism. And obviously bell hooks has like taken her to task for this a couple times. To me, it's less important whether it's her real, like, she's not telling you to go be materialistic like her, but rather, can we have a conversation about how materialism equals power in this society? Or can we talk about why a Black woman being materialistic might be somewhat different than a white man being materialistic? Because, you know, Brooks talks about it in relation to Hurricane Katrina again. And like, we watched on TV as Black women's possessions were taken from them. Everything was taken from them. Mm-hmm. So what kind of a statement is it for Beyonce to come out a year later and be like, no, I own this. This is my shit. This is what I have, you know, like to claim her possession of things. And that to me is an interesting, you know, there's ways to find those kind of twists and tweaks around that to me aren't just about celebrating unfettered, no checks capitalism. And then in her private life, she also does give back a lot. You can feed that into the narrative. I don't think she's out here like going to create the socialist revolution as she sings in front of all the expensive paintings in the Louvre for ape shit. But in some ways, her more recent visuals around that, like standing in the Louvre, to me have almost read comic. Like, it's almost a parody of, why should someone have this much money? Why should one person have this much money? The recent stuff kind of makes me ask that question. I don't know if she's meaning to ask it, but I think it's a useful question to have a conversation around. And that gets around some of the criticism.
Well, I think what's interesting for me about it, just thinking about that, the element of the work is that her being so wealthy, her being so, you know, so successful in the context of capitalism has given her a freedom that a lot of other artists don't have, right? That she can go and, you know, make a movie like Lemonade or Black is King and do these visuals because there's so much money there. And then there is power there. And it's... I think, you know, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house, but there is something, and we're all sort of living in contradictions, you know, which is something bell hooks even, you know, says that we and that is the reality. Being poor in capitalism is certainly not ideal. And I've been there, and it's quite awful. But I love complicating those questions in the work. There's another moment in your book where you almost talk about her character of Sasha Fierce as sort of this drag persona. And then it becomes this simulacrum of a simulacrum, you know, in a way that like Sasha Fierce is this drag persona. It's really interesting. And I was thinking about, you know, sort of politicizing Beyonce, and you were like, well, Beyonce was always sort of politicized. And I wonder if queering Beyonce were a thing, is she always already queer as well? Not in terms of her sexuality, but in terms of queer as a verb.
Yeah,
I like think of queer. I don't identify personally as queer, but like think they're queer is something that you can do. And
I think I like to think of it as a verb too. Queering the ideas around gender, mm-hmm. and that chapter where I'm like trying to think about Sasha Fierce, because there was something so over the top and overblown and overly done about Sasha Fierce. And even that album was like a binary in that it's two discs. This is for like the older folks that remember when you like bought the CD as a disc that you put in your player. But like, you know, you go out to the store and you bought this double album, which didn't need to be a double album, but you had to switch between the discs to get the I Am side and the Sasha Fierce side. And the Sasha Fierce side was all these like more like club tracks, dance tracks. The subject matter wasn't necessarily about love, 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 love will save the day, like all that kind of stuff. Whereas the other side was more ballads, traditional composition, but they both kind of messed with gender in the ways they played off of one another. Mm-hmm. And then Single Lady, she comes out and shows her wedding ring for the first time, which is a contradiction. Mm-hmm. And so then I'm saying like, well, then maybe she wants us to think about contradiction. Who are the ladies? Who is single? What does being a lady mean? Over time, lady has been, you know, white womanhood has been the like space for ladies and all of this stuff. And I use, not to conflate drag at all with trans identity, but I use Janet Mock's book about redefining realness, which is all about, and Lady Chablis actually used some of Lady Chablis, her autobiography, to talk about the ways gender can never be contained in those mm-hmm. binaries. Even if it's a trans story, it just like can't be contained. And so that's what, in some ways, I think is a really cool analysis of Sasha Fierce as a character, who then she kills, right? And then maybe brings back at later times. Like I kind of see Sasha Fierce in other places in her mm-hmm. work, but she publicly stated that she murdered her at one point after she kind of got this concept out.
I saw that. She said she didn't need Sasha Fierce anymore. Sasha Fierce was, because she's this historically very shy. Beyonce is very shy. And so she needed to sort of take on this persona to be this sort of wild woman on stage, if you will. And so it became something that she needed. And she said she didn't need Sasha Fierce anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
After she had kind of exposed all these things about the limits of gender mm-hmm. in a binary sense.
Yeah.
Then she's like, okay, next project. Let's move on to the next thing.
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. One thing I wanted to say before about when we were talking about class and capitalism, that, and I was thinking about this with Black is King, that there is a desire in so much of her work to elevate beauty and Blackness and thwart expectations of what Blackness is. And that kind of imagery, you know, thinking about the Amalfi Coast and, you know, all of the sort of things, what is an Audemars Piguet watch, nipples in your necktie, Hermes briefcase, Cartier top clips, yeah. etc. All of these upper class, you know, sort of things that like we can have access to this too. And mm-hmm. certainly, you know, we can be critical about that, but I think there's a desire to have a kind of Blackness exist in this, and I would say high, not just a high art space, but this in this space of couture and this moneyed space that's really about celebrating Blackness in a diverse way. I mean, there's a real deep desire to create culture that celebrates Blackness and its beauty in a way that is, I would say, linked to something that feels more sort of upper class, but then it is deeply grounded in being, you know, that girl from the block, that like, you know, Third Ward kind of vibe, mm-hmm. that like Houston and the beats and hip hop.
Yeah. Well, and then the flip side of that makes me think of the No Angel video, where she's doing the opposite and like elevating all these common everyday things to question our judgments over what counts as high class, low class, wealthy, poor. You know, just because you don't have money doesn't mean you can't create nice things or find nice things. And just because I do have money doesn't mean my nice things are going to give me what I need. So she kind of has both ends of the spectrum there.
is complicated. And she, in the work, and we can speculate about her personal life, but I think in the work, what I love, one of the things I love about her so much is that she refuses to be placed in any box. She always insists on being really complicated. And I think too, with No Angel, there's sort of an homage to strippers and sex workers that feels very liberating and super sex positive, the sex positivity in her work, particularly on the self-titled album. It just sort of came to fruition, but it was really always there.
Yeah. And one of the duos of videos I love breaking down the most in class or with people talking or just talking about it to anyone who will listen to me is like Partition and Jealous as a two-part story where it's very sex positive, but it's also taking into account the hypersexualized stereotypes that Black women, if you take them both as a story, I think it does this because they run into each other. The track changes into Jealous before Partition is over and the visual part of the album. And then Jealous is all about her kind of like covering up because people are looking and watching. And she does this stuff with the camera placement where the audience is always placed watching her as the other side of the camera, like at that the dinner table where she sips her tea and is trying to get attention. And so this double-edged sword of her being not as Beyoncé, the Black woman personally with Jay-Z and all of that stuff, but as a kind of representation of Black women that want attention and want to be able to express sexuality, but also have to deal with already being stereotyped as too sexual.
Yeah.
I think in those two videos, she offers some interesting commentary that points back at the people watching being like, you're the ones doing this to me. It's not anything I do. And the audience should take more. I think she's indicting the audience a lot is one thing I love about her. And forcing the audience, especially if you're not a Black woman, to ask questions about how you're looking at her and why you're thinking a certain thing about her. Because even when she expresses sexuality a lot in videos, she's very distanced from other people in the frame. It's usually her by herself. Unless she's in a frame with Jay-Z, which then we can draw the personal connection in, right? But other than that, it's very like, so why do people look at her this way? And so it brings up a million interesting questions to me as the non-Black woman audience has to ask themselves about how they're treating, not just on screen and watching her, but then how do you interact with people in your everyday life as well?
I just was thinking about the fact that Britney Spears and Beyoncé are about the same age and came out around the same time, and how Britney was the sort of, you know, my loneliness is killing me, baby, one more time, kind of very sort of virginal.
Like Catholic schoolgirl. Yeah, yeah.
Playing with that kind of Catholic schoolgirl image. And certainly when Destiny's Child came out, they were young, very young girls. And I feel like Beyoncé was never sort of given that space to sort of be a young woman, be placed in this sort of innocent virginal space, even though she very much was from the beginning of her career. And I was just thinking about that in you know, white womanhood and Black womanhood. You know, they're really, I mean, they kind of are contemporaries, but they were in a very different world,
right?
It's a very something very different going on with them, obviously, artistically. I was just thinking about that. And so when Beyoncé, when Naughty Girl comes out, for example, or even when Crazy in Love comes out and like it's her first solo single and she's sexy, like she's so sexy in it, but it's always very elegant and elevated with her. I remember having a conversation with Frank Gatson, who was her creative director and choreographer for many years. He said he would hire ballet dancers to do all the oh dance, you know, so that it would never feel ho-ish to, you know, I'm saying quotes, not that we, you know, not there's anything wrong with being ho-ish. But that it would always sort of be elevated because of the classical dance technique. I'm paraphrasing what he said. So I was just thinking about how sexy she's always been, but it wasn't the same sort of scandal that I'm when Christina Aguilera, her Dirty video comes out and it's just this whole thing, you know?
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that relationship between like what you just said about how Black women are sort of presented as overly sexualized. And so it's, and I definitely have this tension as a Black woman myself, trying to sort of like be in a space of ownership of my sexuality. I'm also trans and we're definitely overly sexualized, but being in a space of owning my sexuality, but not being overly defined by it. And Beyoncé gives us a great template for that.
Yeah.
So inspiring in that realm.
And it's a really complicated like dance that she I mean, no pun, but dance that she has to do around it once you start kind of analyzing each video, like you said, even Crazy in Love, going back to Destiny's Child too, to see how she's had to give just enough, but not enough. And I think that's what comes out in Partition and Jealous. She's finally kind of speaking about it. Like, look, this is what it's always been. Like, you've never given me a chance. Or even in the song Grown Woman, like, I'm a grown woman, but she's mixing it with young footage of her. So she's like mixing that kind of this idea that Black women never get to be girls. They're always seen as older, over-sexualized, all of these things. And where's the space? I mean, it's obviously because the society is organized around principles of white supremacy, mm-hmm. that this is true. And she's like calling that out in little subtle ways that I think are really interesting to then pull out and get people to talk about.
Now feels like a great time for a short break. We'll be right back though. We are back and we're ready to pick up where we left off. I have to say, I was very pleasantly surprised to see that my name was mentioned in your box. In the context of you talking about Sojourner Truth, Ain't I a Woman, and then the title of your book is Ain't I a Diva. Can you talk a little bit about the title, the diva video, and that relationship with Sojourner Truth?
I think some people have misunderstood since the book come out that I'm trying to refer to myself as a diva, which is not the case. Like, it was meant to be, ain't she a diva?
I didn't think that. I never thought that.
I've had a couple of people come up to me and I was like, oh, I would never, the whole point is to not insert myself in that way in all of this work. But it's just kind of this blending of Ain't I a Woman, Sojourner Truth's speech.
Those of you who don't know, I should. I feel like I should let people know that we're referring to Sojourner Truth's Ain't I a Woman speech that she allegedly gave at the Ohio Women's Convention in 1851, that really is 12 years later that it became the speech that we've come to know. But go on.
Well, alleged speech, right? Because we don't know the real... People are saying this more and more, but I still think it doesn't get spread around enough. Like, we don't know what Sojourner Truth said in that speech, because she didn't read or write, so she never wrote it down. There's two different accounts, and I go into all of that, and you can like Google this, it's all over the place. There's two different accounts, one that came up pretty soon after the conference where she gives this famed speech. She also grew up speaking Dutch, so the inflections, which are very contemporary African-American vernacular English, would not have been part of her speaking patterns, but I think it is still an important like text that we see as a performance. And so I was trying to like make this connection between Sojourner Truth and Beyoncé, both as performers and maybe even performance artists. Sojourner Truth was known for singing a lot. She traveled around. She was this truth teller, right? And Beyoncé tours, she's not seen in that same way, but I just wondered what comes out of seeing them connected in that way, right? The lyrics of her song Diva, Beyoncé's song, mirror in some ways some of the things that were said to have been said in Sojourner Truth's speech. And regardless, however it was spoken and however it was delivered, the point was she was fighting for this intersectional look at, like, am I not a woman? I'm a Black, because I'm Black, does that make me not a woman? Right. And I reference your speaking tour as well, which you add these different intersections onto. And I thought of Beyoncé's song, it's Diva. Isn't that somewhat, she's going into this, am I not, you know, she talks about being 15 in my stilettos. I've been, again, age and gender and sexuality and class in some ways. And she's performing it as Sasha Fierce. So again, we have the layer of this kind of gender drag. And she's standing up and making these statements similar to what Sojourner Truth said. And like, how could they inform one another? And how might we think about Beyoncé if she's connected back that far? Like, I think Sojourner Truth is the earliest person I reference in the book. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of setting this span of history that I'm trying to relate to Beyoncé and also like show echoes of them, echoes of all these women through Beyoncé's music. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think what I always love about thinking about the history of Black feminism specifically is that it was always intersectional, because it had to be, because it's just the way that Sojourner saw the world. It's like, well, wait, hold on. All these conversations about race are about Black men, and all these conversations about gender equality are about white women.
Yeah.
And, hey, ain't I a woman? It's kind of really simple when you think about it, but it was this, Black women were just erased in all of those discussions. And I love how much you referenced Kimberlé Crenshaw as well, who coined the term intersectionality, which is such an important concept to think about in relationship to Beyoncé, and then just the women's gender studies that you really are doing with Beyoncé. And I think I've still talked a little bit about this, but I discovered when I was shooting Disclosure through Professor Stryker, who's interviewed in Disclosure, a person named Pauli Murray, which you probably know Pauli Murray.
Yeah.
And I had not heard of Pauli Murray before. And Pauli Murray came up with this term, Jane Crow, to sort of talk about like Jim Crow. It's like, wait, hold on. And again, it was this intersectional analysis of like, but wait, I'm experiencing racial oppression and gender oppression at the same time. And that's a very specific thing. That's Jane Crow. I always like to remind people that Thurgood Marshall said that Pauli Murray's thesis, you know, graduate thesis was the Bible for Brown versus Board of Education, right? And Pauli Murray, it's this person who was assigned female at birth, but who struggled with their gender throughout their life, struggled with their sexuality throughout their life, and was sought, you know, to receive testosterone at several different moments in Pauli's life. So maybe Pauli's on the spectrum of being trans, and the fact that this person, you know, who Crenshaw credits as being the sort of main influence for her coming up with the term intersectionality is Pauli Murray. I think it's just a really interesting historical fact that we should be aware of and acknowledge, and just like say Pauli Murray's name in this context of talking about intersectionality and Black feminism.
Absolutely. And that's really, you know, the whole class came about because I was teaching Intro to Feminism, Intro to Women's Studies. It could be called like Intro to Intersectionality, but feminism is always taught through these white women's stories and, you know, Susan B. Anthony. And not that these people didn't do important things, and sometimes also some kind of bad things or things we wouldn't want to recreate. But, you know, I just wanted to use Beyoncé's music to get all of these names in people's heads if they hadn't already heard of them, and so that they could then go read more and learn more about the history of, just like the history of the United States through the lens of Black women is more instructive to kind of changing things going forward than anything else that I could think of. So it was kind of at first, yes, I love Beyoncé. I'm the hugest Beyoncé fan. I want to talk about her all the time. But also, I want to sneak in all of this stuff, all of these women's names, so that you, whether you do the reading or whatever, you'll still have them on the syllabus and you'll still know them at some point. And maybe you'll hear it and it'll click in your head and you'll say, oh, yeah, I heard about her in that Beyoncé class. Let me go see what she was up to, or, you know.
I think what I also love is that you're very cognizant that you're white and that you are male identified, and that throughout your course and throughout the book, it's really you center the voices of Black women. And you say in the book that, like, you know, everyone is obviously not a Black woman, but that many of us can benefit from the work and the lived experiences and the scholarship of Black women. Can you talk about just, you know, the subtitle of your book, Beyoncé and the Power of Pop Culture Pedagogy, that like the space of sort of being a teacher, being a pedagogue in the classroom, the nature of the classroom setting for you and for many feminists was also a site of like, how do we do this differently? And it sounds like you're very much influenced by feminist sort of ways of teaching and doing pedagogy and the ways in which you've taught politicizing Beyoncé.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk some more about that?
Bell Hooks' Teaching to Transgress is like my teaching Bible. She has some other volumes too, but it's that first one that just really, still going back to it, it's like, yes, this over and over. You're just shouting yes when you're reading it as a teacher, because that's all I wanted to, like, I don't want to teach you what to think. I want to teach you how to think about things going forward. I want to teach you how to take something from history. Like, how do you take two sources and use them to talk to each other, influence each other. Obviously, this is within the scope of Black women's history in the U.S. So I just want people to learn. Reading Black women for me growing up was one of the most foundational things. Like, it taught me more about the world than anything else. Of course, I grew up in a small town in Utah, very religious Mormon, and coming out as...
You were raised Mormon?
Yeah. Yeah, I was.
Wow.
And coming out as a teenager, coming out as gay, I obviously looked for gay voice things to read, you know, gay literature, which had to go to the library at that time. Didn't have the internet yet. It was coming very close, but we weren't at the internet stage yet. And one of the other things I discovered as I was searching through stacks of books was like poetry by Black women, and the language, the experiences, learning about something that wasn't immediately around me because I didn't know Black people in my town really hit me and like broadened my scope of the world and taught me more about myself. Not that the experiences are similar, but just taught me more about being who I am in the world by learning about other people's experiences. Mm. And so it always just had a really special place for me. And I was like, more people need to learn about history through Black women. More people need to be reading Black women, because that's the way we really figure out how power is functioning in this society. That nexus of race and gender is really essential to learn about how to shift the America we want to live in for the future. So that was like kind of my thinking, trying to create this intro to women's studies that would focus on Black women's voices.
Amazing, amazing. In your analysis of Lemonade, you talk about America's sort of broken promise. You know, I always say that, you know, it's about 18 years in her career when she got into formation, you know. Yeah. And I think that, like, I think you referenced this in the book, a week after the Super Bowl. So formation, I think, dropped on Friday, and then she performed at the Super Bowl. Or maybe it even dropped on Saturday, and then she performed at the Super Bowl the next day.
Yeah.
And then people were, like, sort of outraged. People, like, lost their minds.
Yeah.
And Saturday Night Live did a skit that you talk about in your book that where people were like, Beyoncé's Black. The suggestion was that some of her white fans were sort of in denial about her being a Black woman or something, which is kind of interesting. But Lemonade and Formation specifically was when the moment when she really became overtly political in a way that she had not before. And you talk about this broken promise of America. So what are some of your thoughts around Formation and Lemonade in this era and Beyoncé's oeuvre?
Yeah, well, since I had been teaching this class since 2010 and then Lemonade comes out, I'm like, well, now she said it. Now we're done. She said it. Okay.
Tried to tell y'all 6 years ago.
Yeah, it all comes full circle, and she is very explicit about the politics. I mean, Lemonade is also a super, super personal story. Mm-hmm. But one of the things, and I mention it in the book, is that that's not what I do in the class. Like, her personal life, she's gone to great lengths. She's like the only star of her magnitude that can keep so much private. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, we can kind of like, maybe she's having trouble with Jay-Z, but I don't want to assume anything that she doesn't say explicitly about her personal life. So I thought, okay, back up. How do we like look at Lemonade? It's this cheating story. It's this heartbreak. You know, I came to this idea. It's a broken promise, which is what cheating is, an infidelity. You two had a promise with one another, but what if the two ends of the conversation are Black women and America, right? So I read it as more of a representational story about what do you do when you've been lied to over and over and over. And not just Black women in America, a lot of marginalized groups are lied to over and over and over by promises of what the government will do, of, oh, here's freedom, but we're not going to give you anything. You know, there's nothing with it. You're equal now, but we'll see how that goes. Like,
I think about the Malcolm X quote in Lemonade, and then I kept thinking about the promissory note speech from MLK.
Yeah. So it is like a magnum opus of visuals, lyrics, the songs that flow into one another, the damn near one song of every genre is on that album. She really covers this kind of huge scope. Yeah. And one thing I love, this is kind of unrelated, but one thing I love about Lemonade is the way, so she doesn't usually do features much, but she had features from white men on Lemonade, her blackest album. Mm-hmm. But they were only heard and never seen. They're never seen in Lemonade. So she's kind of flipping it.
Interesting. I'm thinking about Jack White and who are the other white...
James Blake.
On that's
Forward.
Right.
Oh. Even the country vibe of Daddy Lessons. Don't get me started on the Dixie Chicks and Daddy Lessons. That was amazing when they did it all together.
You write beautifully about that moment in the book, this Country Music Awards. Yeah.
And country music in general is this like, it was created by black artists, but we think of it now as a super white space in music. And so she's kind of reclaiming all these things and doing to the white artists what has been done to black women all along, mm-hmm. which is like, maybe you're heard but not seen, like your influence is here, but it's not spoken of by name. And so...
And you don't get to benefit from what you've created.
Yes. And so she does that and she takes it and is like, okay, this is now my version of the story. I've been lied to. The promises are broken. Now I'm going to tell you what we need to do to move forward. And it's the same as the cheating story. But if you zoom out on it, I think it's really powerful. Even that bowl that I talk about, the bowl a whole lot.
Freedom. Yeah. I mean, the song Freedom is so explicitly that for me.
Yeah.
It's my favorite song from Lemonade. And it's so... Freedom is so many different things. It's so complicated. And what's so powerful about music, I was rewatching Homecoming this morning to prepare. And Freedom is just such a powerful song. And live, it's just with all the horns and Homecoming. Yes. It's just such a statement that like, it's a cheating story, but it's very much a story of black women, right? That you can't listen to Lemonade and not understand that she's telling so many black women's stories. And what's so beautiful about the specificity of it is how it becomes universal. The specific becomes universal. How many women of all races, how many people of all genders have connected deeply to the work and to the music. And I was thinking about Adele at the Grammys, like in shock that she won Album of the Year. And just like, how did this happen? And why is Beyonce not standing here? I just will never forget that moment. Lemonade was Album of the Year that year.
It was.
Anyway, that's a little stand moment. Not that this whole podcast isn't a stand moment. I'm trying to be somewhat objective. I'm trying to have some kind of critical distance here. But like, I mean, come on. Like, Lemonade changed the whole music industry. And I love how beautifully you talk about her self-titled album changing the music industry. Can you talk a little bit about how game-changing this self-titled album was too? Because it's just, girl.
Yeah, it was 2013, which isn't that many years ago, but it's almost like, I don't remember what before 2013 was, but like I think back to my childhood and I used to love Tuesdays because that was the day new albums came out and you would go to the record store and buy the album you'd saved up for or, you know, whatever. And so like Tuesday was always my favorite day. Beyonce just upended that completely.
Yeah.
With the surprise midnight, end of Thursday, back when everyone was watching Scandal, you know, Scandal was over. We're going to bed.
And oh my God, that's right. Work, Kevin. Yes, take us back.
It was, you know, one of the Scandal, I think it was the fall finale of Scandal even. So people were like, what's going to get us through? What's going to get us through? And Beyonce's at midnight, surprise, not knowing anything. Like, it's hard to not know, oh, this album's working on material, or this artist is working on material, this artist is got a single coming out Friday. Like, she was on tour, but no one expected, first of all, an album, and then also an album that had a video for every song with these huge, lavish productions that everyone had to have signed 300 non-disclosures for, that we didn't know it was coming out.
Yeah.
To have that many people involved with something and to keep it completely silent is another move that shows just how powerful she is now. And then immediately music was released on Fridays instead of Tuesdays. Part of it has to do with the switch to digital stuff, but that had happened a little earlier. And so now people are like, oh, Friday for new music. But that is because of Beyonce, and it's worldwide, like, synced worldwide because Beyonce synced her release worldwide for that. None of that existed before December 2013. So that's all hail to Beyonce for that, that like major shift
in
the music industry itself.
Absolutely. And I think just the visual album is now, some artists have attempted them with mm-hmm. varying degrees of success, but it almost has become this requisite thing. It's like, where are the visuals? And just the undertaking of it. It's like, how do you, I mean, just the budgets. Most record companies don't even have the kind of budget to like make a video for every song. Like,
yeah. So, well, and music videos, you know, music videos used to be events too. So she brought that back. I don't know exactly when they kind of died off, but I mean, in the 80s, Janet Jackson premiering a music video was an event, like a prime time event, or Michael Jackson.
Yeah, Michael Jackson premiering events. Madonna.
Yeah.
I remember Madonna's Express Yourself and Just For My Love being like banned. And I'm like that old, so I remember all that.
Yeah.
Like videos were like a huge thing. I think it really was when CDs dropped off and everything became digital and budgets got cut. It was, you know, it's all of really about things becoming digitized and budgets becoming cut. At that, there was just no money that labels had anymore to put into videos. But Beyonce was at a certain level where she could invest. And it's in that visual experience is so integral to helping tell the story of what it is she wants us to understand about herself, the world, or what she wants to say at any given moment. Mm-hmm. Now, when your book was published, Everything Is Love was just coming out, I think. And then, so Homecoming hadn't happened, Black is King hadn't happened. So you didn't write about those in the book. Do you, what do you want to say to us about those? You know, there's like a lot to say about, but Everything Is Love, Homecoming, Black is King. What do you think about these very distinct eras of Beyonce?
Yeah, I was able to drop, so Homecoming hadn't come out, but the Coachella had happened. So I was able to drop a couple, because mm-hmm. obviously I stayed up until, you know, 6 a.m. to watch it on my computer on the East Coast. So I was able to drop.
I was there opening weekend. I was at Coachella the first weekend. It's my first time, last time at Coachella. I haven't been back. It's my first time at Coachella. And Kevin.
It must have been,
I almost want to cry thinking about it. I swear to you, it was a religious experience. I always feel like it's church when I go to a Beyonce concert, but Beychella was, I still can't believe that it happened. And it's just, you had to be there. I mean, I watch Homecoming a lot and it's a great memory and it's a great document of her process. Wow. Blown away by that. But just to be there with like all those hundreds of people on stage in the marching band. And I was like, okay, you think the marching band's just going to be there for the first, you know, little few songs. And they're there the whole time. And of course it took 4 months to come up with those musical arrangements with marching bands. It's so intricate and it's just the musicality of it is something that I think it's the best concert that probably has ever happened. And I don't think it will be topped for at least 10 to 20 years, if ever. I'm just going on record saying that.
That's what I always say about Beyonce, but then somehow she finds a way.
Yeah, honestly, I after Beychella, I was like, okay, she can retire. Like, no one's going to ever top that, except maybe her. But what are your thoughts?
I'm kind of glad my book came out when it did, because like I was saying with Lemonade, she's kind of started like my whole point was to analyze her music in this way that I didn't see a lot of, especially in 2010, and more came out. And now she's kind of taken on the mantle. And so it's like, she's adding the sources to the Homecoming film with all those quotes, you know, Audre Lorde, Alice Walker. I'm like, well, some of these were on my syllabus. And she's, Everything Is Love, I liked, people gave it kind of a hint, you know, response. I thought it was great as a kind of epilogue to the Lemonade era, as a, you know, whoever the other side of this relationship that you're imagining she's talking about in Lemonade must have done their work, because now we've got this happy little short, not EP, but, you know, short album that is just all about fun and celebration and all of that. There's the materialism stuff, but we can put that over in the corner to have conversations about.
I don't know if we put it in the corner. I think it does feel integral, and it's very hip hop, right? I think that is something that the materialism is very sort of hip hop, and you know, materialism isn't going to save anybody, I don't think. But like, I think it is. It becomes part of hip hop. It's part of a certain kind of musical flex. I think we can sort of enjoy the aesthetic of that without, you know, sort of embracing that ideology or that sort of, you know, way of being.
And it's nice to see that focus on love, the two of them, you know, the happiness of it, I guess, is just a nice epilogue as a closure moment for the Lemonade era, right? And then her going forward into Homecoming, Beachella Homecoming, she's really starting to incorporate more, and Black is King as well, incorporating these diverse influences and sources and musical inspirations, and all from all Black, and being explicit about all the different Blacks. So from, you know, the Josephine Baker homage in B-Day to all of these African artists that she uses on, it makes sense to me. It's just a trajectory. It makes sense.
Yeah. All of these different influences come in. I was thinking about the question of cultural appropriation and like what that is and what that means. And I think that like everyone's influence. I think in a multicultural world, everyone is ultimately going to be inspired and be influenced by things that are probably from another culture. And I think the issue becomes around like exploitation. The issue becomes around who can profit, who gets to profit. So I think that, I mean, I think cultural appropriation is inevitable. And so I think that when people say, oh, that's cultural appropriation in a dismissive way about anything, this isn't about Beyonce, this is just my sort of cultural appropriation rant. But I think when we just say, oh, that's cultural appropriation, and then it becomes dismissive and then always already problematic, it's like, well, everyone's appropriating. It's really about power. It's really about power and who gets to benefit. You know, sort of all the white artists who stole from the Little Richards and the Chuck Berrys, you know, back in the day, the big issue with that is that Chuck Berry and Little Richard weren't getting the same money and the same recognition for their work. So that's what I have to say about cultural appropriation. Because I think we're all influenced.
Yeah, for sure. And the way she gathers influences, I think, is really interesting. I like to analyze her now as a teacher herself. Like, she's creating her syllabus with the influences, the artists she's either samples or features, the visual references she makes, because she's always referencing paintings or films or, you know, so many things. And there's so many takes you can have on it. There's not one right or wrong analysis of a Beyoncé video or film. And so to me, she's creating work that will 100% believe will be like analyzed 100 years from now. Like, she'll be what some of these old 100-year-old artists or writers are. And I think that's rare in the music world. Like, music kind of comes and goes.
Mm-hmm. Particularly pop music.
Yeah. And so she's turned everything on its head as a creator. I don't even know what the right word for it. Artist, creator. I don't know what to call her anymore, because she's just beyond the labels.
She's beyond. Beyond Beyonce.
Yeah.
It's time for a short break. When we come back, more with our guest. And of course, our What Else is True segment. We're back without further ado. So, Kevin, if you could ask Beyonce one question, okay, or maybe two, what would the one or two questions be after all these years of studying her and doing whole courses about Beyonce, writing whole books about Beyonce, like a whole book.
That's such a hard question, because she wants to be private and I respect that. Like, I don't think I would ask her anything personal about her life. I might, you know what, would be a good question. I would be like, okay, I do one of those desert island, what 5 albums would you take to a desert island or something? Like, I'd want to know more about either her process or her inspiration, or like what music has meant the most to her as she's become this icon, this legend. Because I can't imagine asking her anything personal. It seems too, I don't know.
Yeah. It's interesting. I've met Beyonce once.
Yeah, you've met her.
Yeah, I met Beyonce once at the Grammys in 2017, and I just told her how much I loved her, and she was like, I know. Apparently, her team had informed her. And there are many videos. And so I just was so because I had always sort of fantasized about meeting her. And when I was like thinking of meeting Beyonce, I was always in tears. And when I met her finally, I remember saying this to Stephen Colbert, that a sense of calm came over me. It's like when you meet the queen, a sense of calm comes over you. And she was pregnant with the twins at the time at the Grammys.
Oh, yeah.
You can Google the pictures. And it was so funny because Jay-Z was sort of behind her and he was smiling from ear to ear. It was just like everybody like knows like how big this moment is for me. It was like Jay-Z, he's like her. Everybody's like her, that like I am a huge Beyonce fan. And so like I'm meeting her and everybody's like, okay, Laverne's meeting Beyonce. This is the thing. That's what it felt like. It's so funny because I have no desire. I was thinking about this and as much as I love her, I have no desire to necessarily be friends with her. Not that I wouldn't want to be friends with her, but like I love interacting with the work from a distance, right? I actually really enjoy that. I love that I don't, and I've thought a lot about this. I'm like, I'm in Hollywood now. I'm like, why am I not hanging out with Beyonce? I've had these questions. I ask myself these questions. And I'm like, you know what? I don't need to hang out with Beyonce. She's given us so much through the music and through the visuals and the fashion and just so much. And that, for me, is everything. And one other thing I wanted to, you know, we've gone into deeper meanings around intersectional feminism in her work, but just the virtuosity of what she does musically, vocally. She's a brilliant singer. She has an amazing vocal technique. She is an incredible dancer. Just the virtuosity of what she does. I think part of the reason Beyonce is the live performances, and that like how few people have trained to physically be able to get up for 2 hours, 2.5 hours, and just execute what she does. That is just insane and so amazing. And just for anyone out there who's not a fan of Beyonce, great thing is to go to a concert. The live experience that Beyonce will give you is unparalleled. You could start with Homecoming too. The Homecoming will get you together too on Netflix. Homecoming will get you, oh girl, it will get you all the way together.
And her ear for harmonies always like knocks me down. Mm-hmm. So if you're starting, like listen to the backgrounds as well. Listen with headphones and listen to like the backgrounds, like Lemonade, Pray You Catch Me, she's singing like 12 part harmonies or something. And it's just the layered, and it's all her. So just to be able to hear those and create those out of thin air is like magical to me.
Yeah, and because she does so many things, people don't always give her the credit for that. I think starting with Destiny's Child and being in a girl group and harmonizing like that was this great training ground for that ear that is just amazing. There's so much. We could talk about Beyonce all day, obviously. What is the biggest thing that you want to say about Beyonce and her body of work, your relationship to it, to sort of in conclusion?
I just think that obviously it's fun and empowering for a whole host of different groups of people. And people are drawn for their own reasons, whether it's identity reasons, Black women are drawn to listening to another Black woman, you know, whatever it may be. She brings together so many groups of people, you know, maybe some of the white fans after that SNL skit points out brilliantly, I think it's one of the best SNL skits ever done, you know, the day Beyonce turned Black, and they're like shocked and horrified and don't know what to do, because now the white people are like, how do I enjoy the music now? I don't know how to navigate this when she's actually...
You put it on and you enjoy it. That's how you... You just put the music on. The music is amazing.
Right. And you like go out and learn and honor the, you know, the history she's invoking, and you learn about it and you tell someone else about it and you expand your own worldview. That's what I love about, you can use Beyonce's music to just like expand people's views of the world, and hopefully for good purposes, that we all will, that people will fight for more equitable futures for everyone, because there's something in Beyonce's music that you can use to kind of talk about why those things are so important. So to me, she's one of those figures. She doesn't give speech. She sometimes will give a speech, but she's very private. But her music does those things. And it's, I don't want to compare her to other musicians because they're so different, but I know she's very much inspired by Nina Simone. Ever since 2013 in Life is But a Dream, she's been explicitly referencing Nina Simone. And I think she is, like, she's has that inspirational motivational, educational quality about her that
absolutely
people dismiss as just pop music are really doing a disservice to themselves and everyone else. Yeah.
I think, though, at this historical moment, she's been able to let everyone understand and know that it is more than pop music. I mean, I think about Brown Skin Girl, for example. I mean, I think about Nina Simone and colorism and the song Brown Skin Girl and how necessary that song is. And I think how necessary it is from a light-skinned Black woman, too, with all of the sort of violence of colorism that is still pervasive, that, you know, young girls out there, dark-skinned girls can have this song, you know? And I think a lot of, I don't like to get into Beyoncé's personal life either, but I think of her as a mother now, that is certainly, you know, Blue is singing on that song, you know, is such a beautiful moment. And the video with Naomi and Kelly and all of these just beautiful brown-skinned girls, I think it's just, there's something so healing about that. I think because there's been, historically, the ways in which white supremacy, you know, sort of perpetuates colorism and pits dark-skinned women against light-skinned women is just so deeply painful. It's really, really painful. And Beyoncé is just cognizant of that. And it just feels like this beautifully healing moment that doesn't even, I mean, it's hard. There's just not even really fully words for it for me, for that song. And there's a lot of Beyoncé moments like that I'm almost wanting to cry. But I would love to wrap up with a quote from your book. You write towards the end of the book that we need to start over, recenter Kimberly Crenshaw's original theorization of intersectionality as about exposing, challenging, and dismantling intersecting systems of power and oppression, not simply about representation or collaboration. Black women laid the foundation, but everyone has a responsibility and stake in creating a more just world. It's a really beautifully written book. Everyone out there, you should really check out Kevin Allred's Ain't I a Diva, Beyoncé and the Power of Pop Culture Pedagogy. There are other underlined moments that I have that we haven't gotten around to reading from today. Kevin, thank you so much for being here. I'd like to end the podcast with this question. And the question is, what else is true when it comes from my therapeutic process that's based in the community resiliency model and this idea of both and. And it's basically like when things are really challenging in the world, and there are many things that are challenging in the world, and it's easy to focus on those challenging things. What are the things that get you through? What's the both and? What else is true for you? What helps you to get through right now, Kevin?
Obviously, Beyoncé.
Right?
But
yeah,
just music in general. I think when I was a lot younger, I wrote music and played, and you know, I play guitar and sing and write songs. And I've been going back to that this year, like playing music, listening to music of all different genres, and just kind of studying, like diving into music, whether it's Beyoncé or old music I used to listen to in high school, and it's like taking me back. Maybe it's because I'm getting older now and I'm like need to reconnect with my younger self. But like going back to all the, you know, lesbian folk music I used to listen to in high school and remembering.
Like what? Like who?
Oh, you know, like Ani DeFranco and the Indigo Girls and all the, it was the Lilith Fair in high school. Yeah. So I'm going back to the Lilith Fair inspirations and just like remembering how I felt back then. And it's kind of reminding me that we still have like dreams and power, and like don't let all of the stuff going on in the world just keep you down.
Amazing. I love that. Thank you so much for being here. Everyone check out Kevin Allred's book, Ain't I a Diva? Are you on social media? Do you want the kids to follow you, darling?
Sure. I got kicked off my other Twitter account. So now my Twitter is not Kevin Allred. @NotKevinAllred.
You got kicked off your Twitter?
Yeah, because I made a joke about the president, or I pretended to be the president and said I wasn't a very good president. And so they got me for impersonating.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
To be very careful on social media these days. Well, I guess all days. Not Kevin Allred. Is Twitter the only place you're on?
That's mostly. And you can find me from on the other places from Twitter. So
awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here, Kevin.
No, thank you. It's my like dream. talking about Beyonce is good any day, and then talking to you about her is next level. So
thank you. I appreciate that. Beyonce is undeniably great. And over the years, her unwavering dedication to excellence, to surpass what anyone has ever done before, is so incredibly inspiring. And Beyonce just makes you want to work harder. Beyonce makes you want to just jump higher and sing higher and just do it better. And so I'm just really excited that I got to dedicate a podcast to the queen. And I hope you guys all enjoyed it. And guys, it's gender neutral, FYI. I love Beyonce. I love Kevin's take on her. And I can't wait to see what the queen has for us next. Thank you for listening to The Laverne Cox Show. If you like what you hear, please rate, review, subscribe, and share with everyone you know. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Laverne Cox and on Facebook at Laverne Cox For Real. Join me next week with my guest and author of The Color of Law, Richard Rothstein. We'll be discussing legalized residential segregation in the 20th century and the ongoing effects of these policies. You don't want to miss it. Until next time, stay in the love. The Laverne Cox Show is a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from Shondaland Audio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.